It is Friday, November the 3rd. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. Coming up, President Trump says the New York attacker should be executed.
President Trump didn't just mention using the death penalty. President Trump said on Twitter that Saipov should get the death penalty. And it's not only that that's premature, it's that you have a real concern about potentially coloring or otherwise tainting the jury pool.
Europe reacting to the New York assault, the Balfour Declaration in the news, plus celebrating sad songs. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump still thinks the Uzbek immigrant accused of running down eight people with a truck in New York City happened this week ought to get the death penalty, but the president is backing away from trying to send him to the U.S. Detention Center for suspected terrorist at Guantanamo Bay in Cuba. Mr. Trump said Thursday he would love to send the New York terrorists to Guantanamo, but statistically that process takes much longer than heading him to trial through the U.S. court system. The president tweeted of sending 29-year-old Saifullah Saipov to trial in New York should move fast, with the result the death penalty. Stephen Vladek is a professor of law at the University of Texas, and he wrote an opinion piece in Thursday's Washington Post newspaper criticizing President Trump's proposal to send Saipov to Guantanamo. He spoke with VOA's Sarah Williams.
Well, I mean, I think there's no reason why we need to send someone like, you know, Saipov to Guantanamo. The civilian courts have been incredibly efficient and competent at handling even high-profile terrorism cases. I think Guantanamo has all of this baggage related to the abuses that have been committed there over the last 15 years. And I think there are these serious legal questions about whether we would even have the power to detain in potentially indefinite military custody someone who is, you know, lawfully present in the United States at the time of their arrest, like Saipov. It's not at all clear to me that the government would want to even test the legal boundaries of their power in such cases, especially where the claim is not that he is a member of Al-Qaeda, but that he's a member of ISIS, a very different group from the one Congress authorized the use of force against back in 2001.
Well, today, President Trump also, he mentioned the, you know, using the death penalty in this case. Some legal observers might say that could be a little premature.
Well, not just premature. I mean, President Trump didn't just mention using the death penalty. President Trump said on Twitter that Saipov should get the death penalty. And it's not only that that's premature, it's that you have a real concern about potentially coloring or otherwise tainting the jury pool. You know, especially in capital cases, we tend to be very careful about making sure that the jury is making up their own mind, that they're not reaching these verdicts and these sentences because they feel like there's some kind of external societal pressure to do so. And so it's just not helpful. It's a rather serious breach of some fairly longstanding norms for the president to go on Twitter and demand a specific sentence in a case that really has just gotten off the ground.
Yeah, I know in the past, not on Twitter, but other presidents have sort of weighed their personal opinions about legal cases, and that sort of hurt them.
Well, so yes, I mean, there have been consequences in the past. I mean, President Obama got in trouble for suggesting that, you know, even as a general proposition, the punishments for sex assault cases in the military weren't serious enough, and that wasn't even talking about specific defendants. But I think, you know, the larger point here is that it's just not a good idea, no matter what you think the right result is for a suspect like Saipov, for the president to be going on Twitter, on television, in any public forum, and basically prejudging the outcome of the trial. The whole reason why we have so much faith in our criminal justice system is because we expect the trials to be fair and free from these kinds of outside influences.
Saipov has been speaking with authorities in New York, and apparently he has waived his Miranda rights and talked, you know, a lot about what he did, or allegedly, you know, what he did. But is this fairly unusual for a suspect in a case to waive his or her Miranda rights?
You know, I think it's actually not as unusual as people might think. I mean, and this is a pretty, you know, important point that I think gets lost on folks like Senator Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, Senator John McCain from Arizona. You know, interrogating suspects in these cases is actually often quite fruitful, even in the civilian criminal justice system, because many of these individuals, once they're captured, once they're arrested, they actually decide either to cooperate or at the very least that there's no harm in just not talking. And so I think, you know, what really sort of comes through here is that all of the reasons that have been offered for treating Saipov differently, for holding him in military detention, for subjecting him to additional interrogation methods aren't even necessary here, because by all accounts, he's cooperating. You know, I don't know if we'll ever know why he's cooperating. cooperating, but I think the fact that he is just takes all the pressure off of these calls to send him to Guantanamo to put him in a military brig.
Could a lawyer, though, later on say, well, his client was under the influence of medication or was in shock or that kind of thing?
I mean, I'm sure a lawyer could try to argue that, but, you know, if I had to guess, the government, I'm sure, has been extremely careful to memorialize every single aspect of his Miranda waiver to make sure that it can prove to a judge that the Miranda waiver was knowing and voluntary. I mean, this is not the government's first time, you know, around this particular rodeo. And I think that's the point that gets lost on those who think Guantanamo is the right answer. We have had hundreds of these cases in the civilian federal courts since 9/11. We have well-established procedures that the FBI knows how to follow. When you start talking about Guantanamo, you're talking about the unknown. And I just don't know why, in a case of this importance, you know, for a crime of this magnitude, we really want to take that kind of chance.
Stephen Bladick is a professor of law at the University of Texas, and he was speaking with my colleague, Sarah Williams. Before we leave the New York terror attack story, we go now to our London bureau and reporter Henry Ridgewell, who tells us European leaders have been offering their condolences and support in the wake of the New York assault.
Tuesday's attack brought scenes of terror in New York that are sadly familiar in many European cities. British Prime Minister Theresa May wrote on Twitter she was appalled by this cowardly attack. My thoughts are with all affected. Together we will defeat the evil of terrorism. But how? New York's governor called it a lone wolf attack with no evidence of a wider plot. This underscores the changing global terror threat, says security analyst Afzal Ashraf.
A change that has occurred progressively since the 9/11 attacks, where larger plots are now being replaced by these so-called lone wolf attacks using readily available equipment such as vehicles.
The New York attack echoes recent terror incidents across Europe. In June, three attackers used a van to hit pedestrians on London Bridge, then used knives to attack passers-by. Less than 3 months earlier, a lone attacker drove into pedestrians in Westminster before fatally stabbing a police officer. London authorities have since installed barriers on several key roads, but it's impossible to fully protect against such attacks, say experts.
We're talking about an enormous number of areas where we're talking about billions, possibly, of dollars worth of protective barriers. And all of these barriers will, of course, be successful, but the terror threat will move on.
In France, the Prime Minister described the New York attack as a stark reminder of the global threat.
Le niveau de menace est élevé. Il est élevé.
The threat level is high around the world, and our objective is to provide credible answers, firm answers, and to guarantee a high level of security for French people.
France has suffered more than most, with hundreds killed in recent attacks in Paris and Nice. French President Emmanuel Macron Tuesday signed a new anti-terror law with sweeping powers.
I will also allow for very specific measures to fight against terrorism by allowing particular raids or by having measures on a case-by-case basis against identified individuals.
US President Donald Trump wrote on Twitter that he has ordered more robust, extreme vetting of travelers. Europe is unlikely to follow that path, says Ashraf.
It's not at all clear to me that there is a form of vetting which will increase the already present safeguards sufficiently to detect potential terrorists.
Security analysts stress it is almost impossible to fully protect against so-called lone wolf terrorists intent on causing harm. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
That Tuesday attack in New York has raised concerns about increasing extremism among some ethnic Uzbeks originating from the Central Asia region. Thomas Lynch of the National Defense University here in Washington tells VOA the last 18 to 24 months show that Uzbeks or Uzbek-speaking Kyrgyz and Tajiks are disproportionately involved in lone wolf terror strikes. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
This is VOA's International Edition. Thursday marked the 100th anniversary of the so-called Balfour Declaration. It's a 67-word pledge written by Lord Arthur Balfour, a British Foreign Secretary, in a letter to financier and Zionist leader Lord Walter Rothschild to help create a Jewish homeland in Palestine. It also cautioned that nothing shall be done, in its words, which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine. That declaration, which came during the First World War, served as a basis for what came to be called the British Mandate for Palestine, approved by the League of Nations in 1920. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu marked the occasion on Thursday in London and spoke of its importance during his trip to Britain.
I very much appreciate this gesture by the Prime Minister of Britain and the government of Great Britain. The Palestinians say that the Balfour Declaration was a tragedy. That wasn't a tragedy. What's been tragic is their refusal to accept this 100 years later. I hope they change their mind, because if they do, we can move forward finally to making peace between our two peoples.
Palestinians still in search of their own state have demanded an apology from Britain for the Balfour Declaration, which resulted in the mass displacement of their people in 1948, a matter that continues to reverberate today. Russell Stone is a professor emeritus at American University's Center for Israel Studies. He tells VOA's Victor Beatty Lord Balfour was deliberate in using vague and ambiguous language.
It said the British government viewed with favor, it didn't establish anything, the establishment of a Jewish homeland in Palestine. It didn't say what the nature of that would be either, and it went on to further state that it would not in any way affect the rights of other people living in the area. It was conveyed in a letter to Lord Rothschild of England, who in turn was expected to transmit it to the organized Jewish community in England, representing the emerging ideals of Zionism, the creation of a Jewish national state in Palestine.
An author of a book on the document, Jonathan Schneer, says it's so divisive, referring to the Balfour Declaration today. Zionists think that the Balfour Declaration laid the foundation stone for modern Israel. They're right to think that. By the same token, non-Jewish Palestinians and Arabs see it as the foundation stone of their dispossession and misery.
Well, it certainly marked a turning point for them as well. They had been governed before that by the Ottoman Empire out of Turkey, and it was really a minor province of the Ottoman Empire, so they were left more or less on their own. There wasn't a huge Arab population in the area, but it was larger than the Jewish population.
Writing this week in the Daily Telegraph, the British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson said he's a friend of Israel, but he also said he's, quote, deeply moved by the suffering of those affected and dislodged by the birth of the Balfour Declaration in the modern-day state of Israel. Quote, the vital caveat in the Balfour Declaration intended to safeguard other communities has not been fully realized.
This is a reaction to the demand by organized Palestinians for an apology from England for what has happened to them. England was trying to pull out of the area at the time.
Looking forward to the future, what do you think the Balfour Declaration will mean for Israel and the Palestinians?
Well, it's 100 years. It's just an anniversary that generates a certain amount of attention, but that in itself will not have any influence on the future of the situation. That future depends on whether some agreement or accommodation can take place between Israelis and Palestinians in how to live together in the area, politically as well as socially and economically.
Are you optimistic or pessimistic?
Guardedly patient. Peace isn't going to break out tomorrow. We can only hope that in the long run, a modus vivendi will emerge. I'm not optimistic in the short run, but we must remain hopeful in the long run.
In London, thousands are expected to converge on Saturday for a rally with the theme, Make It Right for Palestine, organized to demand justice and equal rights for Palestinians. Time now to find out what's happening in the world of social media. Here's VOA's Andrew Palchevsky.
The top lawyers for Facebook, Google, and Twitter appeared before the U.S. Senate Intelligence Committee this week at a hearing on Russian misinformation on social media. So after 2 days of intense back and forth, here are three takeaways. First, the interference was bigger than we first thought. Facebook, for instance, said as many as 126 million Americans may have seen ads purchased by Russia. Twitter said they've discovered more than 130,000 tweets linked directly to Russia's Internet Research Agency. And Google cited more than 1,000 YouTube videos linked to Russian misinformation efforts. It brought into question how far these campaigns have gone and whether they're still going on today. Second, social networks vow to address misinformation, but they aren't so keen on having the government do it. Now, last month, senators introduced what they call the Honest Ads Act. It would require social networks to publish who purchases ads, how much money is being spent, and who is being targeted. Now, the representatives from Facebook, Twitter, and Google all said that they're already voluntarily planning to regulate ads. But when asked if they would support the Honest Ads Act, none of the three companies committed. That's because social media companies don't want to be regulated by the government. They feel that they can police their content internally. Now, this was one of the first signs that policing information on social media could end up being a big fight between those companies and the U.S. government. And finally, Russia used some unusual tactics to try to divide the American public. As Facebook, Twitter, and Google testified in front of the Senate Intelligence Committee, the intelligence panel in the House of Representatives released 24 ads that they called a representative sample of the thousands purchased by Russia. Now, this is the first time we're getting a look at these ads. Some of them appealed to groups like Black Lives Matter and gun owners, fitting with previous reports about the ads' focus on divisive issues. But there were also ads focused on specific candidates, including one very strange ad that depicted Satan and Jesus arm wrestling. Satan says that if he wins, Hillary Clinton wins, while Jesus says it won't happen on his watch. The bottom line, the more we learn about Russian influence and interference on social media, the more questions that arise. And even though this hearing was the first, it most certainly will not be the last. Some senators are already calling for Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey, and Google CEO Sundar Pichai to testify at their next hearing.
Many thanks to you, Andrew. That is VOA's Andrew Palchevsky. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
On the Croatian island of Pag, cheesemakers produce some of the best cheese in the world with their renowned Paski Sir brand cheese. Martina Pranar is the assistant director of Paski Sirana. She says the secret of the cheese is Pag Island itself. The island, she says, has scarce vegetation, but full of aromatic herbs and salty Bora air blown in from the Adriatic. Bernard says they've been exporting about 5 tons of cheese each year to the United States, but production is limited because it takes 12 sheep to produce the milk for just one wheel of cheese. Wine and cheese expert Rene Bakalovic says the cheese is excellent.
The smell is unbelievably intensive, and in your mouth, this cheese melts.
The island's sheep milk cheese has won the Gold Medal Global Cheese Award for the past 2 years. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. It is time now for our music feature. In 2015, an article in Psychology Today, Dr. Christine Baccio wrote, "It's not surprising that people enjoy upbeat songs, but what is surprising is the enduring popularity of sad songs."
Guess there are times when we
Elton John nailed it when he sang Bernie Taupin's lyrics. Sad Songs was a big hit for Elton John, who still has that song on his playlist, one of the most requested by his fans. Another of Elton John's sad songs, which has topped the charts, is Blue Eyes.
Blue eyes, baby's got blue eyes, like a deep blue sea on a blue, blue day.
John was born Reginald Kenneth Dwight in March of 1947 in the Pinner area of London. He's a renowned singer, pianist, and composer, working with lyricist Bernie Taupin since 1967. Decade career, Elton John and Bernie Taupin have sold more than 300 million records and have won just about every award singer-songwriters can win. And for Elton, well, he's as busy today as he's ever been, out on the road, touring, and making people very happy with those sad songs, like his 1989 hit, Amazes Me.
You're a cool little one, my dark southern breeze sweeps through my fingers and it amazes me. Dixie's Shadowland, your envy shelters me. Lay down your burden, mystery of ebony, and it amazes me. Oh, it amazes me, baby, like you, babe, could be this tune.
You know, what amazes me is that Elton John is 70 years old. It's kind of hard to believe. Makes me feel older, I have to tell you. Listen, thanks everyone for joining us here on The Voice of America for International Edition. Always good to have you with us. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Carl Starling, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Friday. Now a bit more from Elton John.
Well, she's awake in the trees. I'm drifting in your hoodoo. And it amazes me. Down the Magnolia State. Got a hold on me. I got no blues to preach. Just the Mississippi Company. And it amazes me. Oh, it amazes me. Maybe the hippie could be this too. It amazes me. It amazes me. What drives me crazy is that big fat yellow moon. And it amazes me.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Secretary of State Rex Tillerson has announced that pending consultation with Congress, the United States will provide up to $60 million to support a promising and developing regional counterterrorism effort in the Sahel. The assistance will support activities for a joint counterterrorism force that the group of five G5 Sahel states, Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger, agreed to set up earlier this year to fight terrorist and violent extremist groups such as Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, ISIS, and associated groups. In a statement, Secretary Tillerson said, defeating terrorism depends on making sure terrorist organizations cannot have safe havens on any continent. This is a fight we must win, and these funds will play a key role in achieving that mission. He went on to say that this pledge will bolster our regional partners in their fight to ensure security and stability in the face of ISIS and affiliated groups and other terrorist networks. In remarks at a Security Council briefing on peace and security in Africa, U.S. Representative to the United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley spoke of the violence that has spread across the Sahel, not only from terrorists, but from criminals who traffic in drugs and human beings seeking to profit from the chaos in the region. She praised the men and women of the armed forces of the G5 Sahel countries, as well as the UN peacekeepers who are serving in the world's most dangerous peacekeeping mission in Mali. Ambassador Haley promised that the United States will continue its longstanding bilateral support to the G5 members' security forces. Speaking of the new pledge of up to $60 million for the Joint Counterterrorism Force through bilateral assistance, she noted that the force will need ongoing support and that the United States is eager for opportunities to work closely with its partners to make the effort a successful one. Ambassador Haley emphasized, however, that the G5 force must be first and foremost owned by the countries of the region themselves. We expect, she said, that the G5 countries will take on full regional ownership of the force within a period of 3 to 6 years, with continued U.S. engagement. This is the approach that will be most effective in the end, in freeing the region from terror. We welcome this regional ownership of security and stabilization in the Sahel, said Ambassador Haley, and we will continue to stand with the people of the region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.